last week we started to wrap up a course I'd done a while ago, or a series I'd done a while ago, on the Book of Leviticus. And it is a bit weird to our ears at first, but we'll see. This is quite perhaps more straightforward than we think, and certainly more relevant. So I'm reading in the centre of Leviticus 16, starting at verse 15. This is the centre of the whole of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. So Leviticus 16, starting at verse 15. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, that is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil, and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling it over the mercy seat and in front of the mercy seat. Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place, because of the uncleanness of the people of Israel, and because of their transgressions, all their sins. And so he shall do for the tent of meeting, which dwells with them in the midst of their uncleanness. No one may be in the tent of meeting from the time he enters to make atonement in the house, in the holy place, until he comes out and has made atonement for himself and for his house and for all the assembly of Israel. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all round. And he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his fingers seven times and cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. And when he has made an end of atonement for the holy place and the tent of meeting at the altar, he shall present the live goat. And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel, and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them on the head of the goat, and send it away into the wilderness, by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities on itself to a remote area, and he shall let the goat go free into the wilderness. We'll come back to those words a bit later, and see how the New Testament picks up on them. I'm going to read to you a New Testament reading, a Gospel reading from John chapter 1. I'm going to read verses 35 to 37. So John 1, 35. The next day, again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus and saw him following. He said, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" Tourists sometimes comment how close you can get to, say, Buckingham Palace, or even more so, 10 Downing Street. If you go to Hollywood, you can get a street map of where all the stars live. You can literally drive at the end of their drive and see their house just a few yards. It's remarkable. However, I do think it would be different if you got too close, if you went up and rang the doorbell, if you crossed over the security barrier, then police or security will, maybe some Dobermans will greet you, shall we say, before you got to the front door. How would we get in? Well, you'd have to meet the right conditions, a certain criteria. You'd have to be invited, or have a pass, or be accompanied by an official or family member. How do you enter into God's house? Well, the bits of the Bible we're thinking about at the moment, the tabernacle was in the desert, so as Israel had those 40 years wandering from Egypt into the promised land, they had this big tent which symbolized God's house. Later, when they're settled, that became a permanent brick house, the temple. That is God's house. It's not the same as a church building or a synagogue. It was unique. There's one in the world. And it sends out this message from God. Draw close to me, but not too close. I want to live with you, but I am holy. And if you come too close, or the wrong way, that can be fatal. Now, what is going on here? And why does it even matter to us? Why do Christians still have Leviticus in their Bible? Well, why does it matter? Well, what we've said as we've gone through Leviticus before is it's like stabilizers for reading the rest of the Bible. You have concrete terms that explain spiritual realities. It's not that the spiritual things aren't real. You could say they're hyper-real. So the New Testament, Jesus' death and resurrection and so on. These are amazing things. But in the New Testament itself, it's set against the Old Testament backdrop. And when you look at it that way, it's even more so. We see the whole significance, more dimensions to what and depth to what Jesus did, but also more permanence. You don't have the literally bloody mess that I just read from Leviticus 16. So what's going on? Well, there's actually strong links here between this and what we're looking at in Romans in the evening. God made a perfect world and dwelt with his people. That's the story so far before we get to Leviticus. And in this perfect world, there's a specific and special meeting point, the Garden of Eden. But they broke the first law that God gave. And so they're cast out of Eden. They're cast out to the east. And an angel's put there to stop them coming back. And the whole world is spoilt. Things go wrong. And so the whole Bible, the story of the whole Bible, is how do we get back to that unspoilt world and live with God as friends? And with each other as friends. And so the tabernacle, the temple, is God's house. It's where you went to meet with him safely. But it was full of symbolism that this was a mini world. There was a symbolism of the pre-fall world, and particularly of Eden, including an angel that was embroidered into the curtains. So there were these curtains that marked the way back through, that you were going into holier places, and the angel guarded the way back to the Holy of Holies. Not anyone can just wander in there. Only one person can, the high priest, once a year, and that's this day we just read about in Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement. And the priest represented the people, and in the Day of Atonement specifically, he symbolized Adam. And we've thought about that in Romans, haven't we? How Adam is the head of all people. He's the start of all people. And so symbolically, he is the Adam going back into Eden. So the layout of the temple is the way into the temple is on the east. So the closer you are to God, you have to go west. And as you go east, you're going away from God, symbolically. It's not that God lives in the west. But that was the symbolism following from Eden. So all year long they worshipped God, but we've seen in these various rules that we sort of shot over last week, there's sin and impurity would build up because God is so holy. You accidentally even broke these rules. And so Leviticus 16 is like a spiritual spring clean of God's house. And it happens at the turn of the year. So the year has ended, we do the spiritual spring clean, and the new year starts. And the significance for us is because all of this points to Jesus Christ and what he has done. So how do we enter God's house eternally, and how do we draw near now? Well, lots is happening in the chapter, and the way it's written is it goes through sequentially. So you sort of jump around a little bit and a bit of back and forth, and potentially it's confusing. So I just want to focus on a couple of main events and main, if you like, characters in the chapter. That is the high priest and the two goats, and how all three of them point us to Jesus Christ. And also, they show how we as sinners come to a holy God. So firstly, there's the high priest. Now, he's mentioned all the way through, but particularly at the beginning and the end, in verses 1 to 14 and 32 to 34. And what it shows us is we need a high priest. We need a high priest to to come into God's house. Now, interestingly, chapter 16 is the same day as chapter 10. In fact, chapter 10 through to this point is all on the same day. And chapter 10 was about Aaron's sons who have been struck down dead by God because they enter their own way on their own terms. And between that and this, verses 11 to 15, are all these holiness laws. They show about how God is holy, faithfully holy. How can we meet with him? How can we meet with this holy God? Well, not on our terms, but on his. And before we get to the ritual and the significance and the Day of Atonement, the priest needs to be prepared. And so first is his clothing. And this is humble clothing, not the normal king-like clothing that priests wore. So when they represent God to the people, that's half of their job, they wore these very regal clothes and all this symbolizing of God's heart for Israel. But when they're representing the people to God, they wear humble, plain white clothes. And the symbol is of purity. So there's no sweat, sign of the fall, and humility. Before, so they have this wash, ceremonial cleaning, then they wear their clothes, this humble clothing. And it shows that the priest is a sinner himself, these verses, because he brings a bull to be sacrificed for his own sin. And that has to, the blood cleanses the parts of the temple he's going to use. So there's a special washing, preparation, clothing before he acts on behalf of the people. And also he does it afterwards. So symbolically what he's doing is tidying up God's house and cleaning it. And that represents the world, God's world, that needs tidying up and cleaning. And he needs to be pure to do so. And so at the end, he's taken all the muck out, spiritually speaking, and so he is dirty, just like when we do an extensive deep clean in our house. Afterwards, actually, we need a clean, don't we? So he needs to be cleansed before he does it. He needs to be cleansed afterwards because he's now, in a sense, made himself dirty in doing it, and anyone else involved in the ceremonies. And this is repeated every year. So it's a reminder that sin is always with us, and to come to God, it needs purifying. Always having that way to God blocked off and needs to be cleared. Now this is picked up in the New Testament about Jesus being our priest, and he presents himself as humble and pure. He is God and man, so he represents God to man and man to God. And but he's in a different order to those priests. The priests repeated their work each year. Jesus, we're told, does it once for all, and then he sat down. In Hebrews, he sat down, meaning he finished the job, and he has finished it forever. Because he was a priest with no sin, and because he brings a better offering. Now, ministers today, people like me, they lead and they preach and do much that a priest did, but they don't do the sacrifices. Because that sacrifice has been done. We enter together in and through Jesus Christ. So that's the priest. Now the bigger part here is the goats, the two goats, in mostly in the centre of the chapter in verses 15 to 31. And this is the heart of the ritual. In fact, this is the heart of the first five books of the Bible. And a lot of the Bible and a lot of things that Jesus says rests on these two goats. Now, this is not about the priest now. This is about the whole community. So the priest now he's cleansed. He performs a ritual for all of Israel. So in verses 7 to 10, two goats are selected from the flock. They have to be perfect. And they both stand at the entrance to the tabernacle, that is to the east of the tabernacle. And then lots are drawn and a roll is assigned to each of the goats. So the first one will head west and the second will head east. So one will head west into at the gate, at the entrance of the tabernacle. He will now go west and he'll go into the tabernacle and he will go into the Holy of Holies to God. And he is killed and he enters by his blood, by his own blood. And the priest representing Adam goes into God's presence. He goes representing Adam and therefore humanity. He goes back into the perfect unfallen world into God's presence by the blood of the goat. The remains of the goat are then taken outside of the camp, outside of where they all live, and is burnt. So there's nothing left. The second goat goes east, away from the tabernacle, and out of the camp and into the wilderness. And he's cut off. But before he does that, at the gate, at the entrance to the tabernacle, the priest lays his hands on his head and confesses the sins of Israel. And then someone takes him, someone who's been specially appointed, takes him out, and symbolically he takes the sin of the people away and out, where it's dealt with, away from the community. So those two goats show two needs for God's people. And these needs are still our needs, as far as God's concerned. Draw near by sacrifice, but go away because of your sin. So the priest represents them to God by the blood of the goat, and he takes them, represents them into God's presence. And the other goat away into the wilderness. So the first goat goes to the Lord. The second goat, it depends on your translation, here it says into the wilderness. Some say to Azazel. And that's the word that's there. What does that mean? Well, some think it means maybe a demon, to go back to sender. The first English translation says a scapegoat. And of course, we use that in everyday English. Someone is scapegoated. They get the blame for what is someone else's fault. It happens in politics, happens in work. So what does this word mean? We don't actually know. Can't 100% say what that word means. Other than what it might derive from. But the meaning is clear, because you see what happens. It's described so clearly what happens, that the sins of the people are symbolically transferred and taken away. The goat takes away our blame, our sin. He's the scapegoat. And that's what is happening here, isn't it? So it's very important. It's repeated every year. And we're told at the end of the chapter, the people are not to take this lightly. They're not to think that purely this happened, they benefit automatically. Rather, they are to prepare themselves spiritually. It's a time of somber reflection. And they needed faith. They needed faith that this is God's way of dealing with their sin. And then they see the drama unfold. They see their representative go into God's presence, to the inner court of the house, to the centre of the house, the Eden, by the blood of the goat that cleanses the way for them. And they see their sin go onto a goat and taken away, never to be seen again. And that shows the cost. See, all that, I'd still do this. You read Leviticus, if you ever do read Leviticus, all these animals getting it, and blood everywhere. And you think, that's a bit of a mess. You think, there's a cost here. In the Bible itself, animals are not worthless. They're not just vegetables or inanimate things. They're living beings. Now they're treated humanely. They had to be. That's part of the law. They have to be treated humanely. But so many are killed in the worship of God. So it shows that people are worth infinitely more than these animals. And you think as you read through it, what a bloody mess. I mean, literally blood everywhere. And what a financial cost too. These animals, their livelihood is financially costly to do this. Approaching God is costly, and it's a significant event, and something that's lost on us. Why we need these books, because for us it's not costly, because you just turn up at church, or even now just click on a link, and you're doing it in this sense. But it becomes clear, even before we get to the New Testament, where it's crystal clear, that the blood of animals does not remove sin. So this is a demonstration of what needs to happen spiritually. They put their trust in this. They approached this day by faith, in that what this day will point towards will fulfill what they need. The for real event, if you like. And of course, this all points to the work of Jesus, particularly Good Friday, Easter, and the Ascension, and shows what would otherwise be very hard to see. When you see the cross and the resurrection and Ascension, wonderful as they are, they standalone, it's quite hard to see what Jesus is doing. But this backdrop shows us. So we see that the cost of Jesus' death, but also how Jesus' death is greater with a bigger impact. Just as the role of priest points to Jesus, but the one who will represent God to people and people to God, but Jesus does it in a greater sense. And so both of the goats point to Jesus. Jesus is often referred to as the lamb, the sacrificial lamb. The word goat I don't think is used in the New Testament, apart from separating the sheep and the goats. But the imagery is there very strongly. So the first goat goes to the Holy of Holies by their own blood. The priest enters by the blood of the goat, and in doing so represents everyone else. But he can only go by the blood. Now Jesus does not go into the Holy of Holies, but he goes to where they represent, where they point to. He goes into the heavenly throne room itself. He doesn't go back in time to Eden, but he assures us of a new creation, a new heaven and earth, that through him we will enter. Literally and physically we will enter. Because we are united to him. So there's a sense in which we have a seat in heaven now. That's why our prayers are heard, because we have our seat there in him. The cross is our Day of Atonement. Now remember, I mentioned that the tabernacle, then the temple, with the zones, as you got holier, were separated by curtains. And there was this thick curtain separating people from the Holy of Holies. Come close, but not too close. It's like a no-entry sign, and the ultimate no-entry symbol of an angel with a sword. You can't come back here. Reminding us there's no way back to Eden. But of course, as you know, on that first Good Friday, as Jesus died, the curtain was torn from top to bottom, that the way to God now is open and free. There's no need for a priest to do this every year, because we have a greater high priest. Jesus entered by his own blood once and for all. Now there's nothing that blocks our way back to God. Now there actually is more that Jesus does, of course, than what happens on the Day of Atonement. The resurrection. Jesus was vindicated by God. And so we are made, by faith, are made right. We're given this new status now. We're now innocent. But what about our sin? What happens to our sin? Well, that second goat, the scapegoat, what happens to him? Well, hundreds of years after the events of Leviticus 16, but still 700 years BC, Isaiah wrote of a person, a suffering servant, who bears our sin. So the image of the high priest laying his hands, pressing them down on the goat, Isaiah applies to a person, a man, who will take the sins, not symbolically, but actually take them in his own body and suffer for their sins. And the New Testament writers use similar language of Jesus bearing our sin, taking our sin as his sin. John the Baptist says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." In Romans, we've thought about this a little bit, and we'll think of it some more, is this idea of impute, which means to credit or consider. So our sin actually becomes rightly his sin. He takes it away. So the second goat goes out into the wilderness. So the first goat goes towards God, but these leftovers are burnt outside of where the people dwell. And so Jesus, as he dies, he like the second goat, he goes outside of the community. He goes outside of Jerusalem. You know, the old hymn, a green hill far away, without, outside of a city wall. He goes outside of the community. Just like the first goat is burned up outside, just as the second one is cast outside, Jesus is cast outside where he dies. And throughout the Bible, sin results in being cast away from God. And that sin being cast away happens in one of two ways. Either it means the sin with the sinner is cast away from God, or the sin has to be somehow detached from the sinner and cast away from God. And being a sinner cast away from God means being cast away. It is what you ask for. You say, "I don't want to know God." And he says, "Okay, go." But being cast away from God means being cast away from anything good from God. anything enjoyable, friendship, anything that's nice, you don't have away from God. Our life now, Christian or non-Christian, is this halfway between, you know, as someone put it before, Christians will never be as close to hell as they are now. And non-Christians will never be as close to heaven. Anything good we have is from God. So that permanent being cast away is away from everything that's good. It's only what people ask for. But in Christ, he takes away our sin. He's the one that's cast out, not us. Our sin is taken away. So last week in Romans 5, in the evenings, we saw that Jesus is the new Adam. He reverses the effects, for real, forever. And so we see that here. So the priest represents Adam going back to Eden on behalf of Israel, God's bride. Jesus died for his bride, the church. And just as Eve came out of Adam's side, so the new Adam saves his bride by his side being pierced. And he said, it is finished. It does not have to be repeated, but it does need to be received by faith. As it did then, so it does now. So see your need by faith for your sin to be transferred. And then now to enter, to draw near. Not by a fallible priest, but by Jesus Christ, the God-man. In Christ you come into the throne, and before the very throne of grace, by faith, but one day by sight in the new creation. Now there are some versions of Christianity which at the same time lacks confidence and has this, it's all been done on the cross, or it's all been done by some other ritual. So people lose confidence and have a, well, it's automatic, it doesn't matter, I'll just carry on sinning. And what we see in Romans from tonight, and what we see in Leviticus from this chapter onwards, is how do we respond to what he's done? Now he's taken our sin, and the answer is holiness. And we'll think some more morning and evening about what that actually means. But we have a confidence, what this chapter gives us, what we've seen in Romans in the evening, is a confidence that by faith we can see Christ remove our sin. And also by faith see how he takes us to God. And he's taken our sin far away so you can go very close. That your sin is no longer yours. By faith, by his blood, you come to God the Father in the holiest place. So your confidence is not in yourself, but in him. We simply confess our sin and our need, and Jesus removes it. And confidence that in him, by the Spirit, you enter God's presence. Now by faith, in the future by sight.